on the Equestrian Legacy Radio Network.
Gonna dance in the desert, dance in the desert, gonna raise a little dust. Gonna dance in the desert, dance in the desert with the girl I love. Gonna sing under the moonlight, sing under the moonlight, lift her voices up. Gonna sing singing to the moonlight with the girl I love. Gonna dance in the desert, raise a little dust, sing into the moonlight, lift your voices up, make a little music before the sun comes up. Gonna dance in the desert with the girl I love. Watch the sunrise, a beautiful sunrise from up above. Gonna sit and watch the sunrise, watch the sun rising with the girl I love. Gonna dance in the desert, raise a little dust, make a little music before the sun comes up. Watch the sunrise and we'll sing from up above. And I'll dance in the desert with the girl I love. Sunset, right into the sunset, thank the Lord above. I can ride into the sunset, right into the sunset with the girl I love. Gonna dance in the desert, raise a little dust, make a little music before the sun comes up. Right into the sunset, thank the Lord above. I can dance in the desert with the girl I love. With the girl I love.
Well, good afternoon from Nashville, Tennessee. I'm your host, Gary Holt, and joining me every first Thursday of the month is Backcountry Horseman of America, our good friend, Mr. Jim McGarvey, who is the past national chairman of the Backcountry Horsemen of America, joins us. And Jim, how are you this morning?
Doing great, Gary. Good to be with you again, as always, going into starting our sixth year, I think, yeah? Something like that.
It is going into 6 years together, and it's been fun.
It has been fun.
Yeah, you brought some great guests to the show to visit with us. And today you have two great guests. Who do you have joining us today?
Yeah, we've had a lot of great guests because the two fellows today are particularly interesting and good friends. And Phil and Casey Hufstetter, Phil the dad, Casey the son. I think we first met maybe 2010 or 11 at a national board meeting for the Backcountry Horsemen. And I think we really got to know each other. I believe it was 2012, the national board meeting was hosted by Phil and his folks in Eugene, Oregon. And in April of, I believe it was 2012. And then Cindy and I were married a few months before. Then we went to Eugene for the national board meeting. And from there, we went on a pack trip that summer with Phil and Casey that was a lot of fun out in the Mount Jefferson Wilderness. We can talk about that when we get going. But welcome, Phil and Casey. Glad to have you both on.
Thank you.
All right. The what was the name of the lake right there at Mount Jefferson that we camped at?
Sandy M.
Santian, yes. That was a lot of fun. I know Phil got a bit injured in the parking lot going back to the trailhead, and the horse got thrown, and it was a long recovery, wasn't it, Phil, seemed like?
Yeah, you might say it's been still an ongoing. The horse rolled over the saddle horn, squished my heart, and broke a couple of valves. But being honored and everything, I haven't got that fixed yet. I just resaddled up and went back again. someday I'll slow down long enough, and they'll fix that.
Oh, gosh. Just cowboyed up, didn't you, Phil?
Boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was...
Well, tell us a little bit about your background, and let's kind of start with Phil. Where are you from originally, and how'd you end up in Oregon?
Well, I was born and raised in Oregon. I'm a fifth-generation packer, and about nine generations earlier than that, our relatives came over from Germany, and so we wound up in the packing business five generations ago, and what it boiled down to was they were packing for and in the Cascades and all over Oregon, and our third generation packers were packing meat for the railroad. So we have out in Oregon there was large timber companies that put railroads back into the high country, and my forefathers and my grandfather specifically would go up with a string of 40 head of mules and pack meat from the meat hunters. They would pack it, put it on dry ice, and take it down to the railroad crossings, and they'd load it on railroad cars and take it to the actual logging camps. So we were providing all the packing for the railroads through most of Western Oregon and Eastern Oregon.
What years would those have been?
Before I was born. I was born in 47. So it was the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s, and specifically getting into the later 50s when the railroads were way back into the high country in our area. They started logging.
Wow.
Oh, the high elevations, the big yellow belly pine, ponderosa, and such as that, and the big Doug fir.
Wow. And Casey, you didn't have any choice in the matter, did you? I guess you just had to come right along and back.
Nope, born and raised in the saddle. I was in the saddle at 6 months old, in the side of an old pack mule in the pannier boxes. And the pieces of plywood that were in the pannier boxes actually became my crib when I was in the different camps and in the different pack trips. So I don't know any different.
Wow. That is pretty cool. And to have had that many generations that have been packers is pretty awesome. Pretty stinking awesome. So, Jim, I'm going to turn things over to you.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. It's I know that the packing is a family tradition in a lot of instances, but that's really a long history. You may be setting a record in the United States for that, the Hufstetter family, for sure. Well, now you still are in, I mean, you do packing. Tell us what kind of packing or what kind of business of the packing you do these days now.
Well, I've pretty much taken over the pack string together, myself and my son, Cody. And most of the stuff we're doing is a lot of volunteer work. We do a lot of contracts for the Forest Service, do a lot of contracts for the BLM, but we're integrating into, we do a lot of Northwest Youth Corps packing, a lot of trail crew packing. There's a lot of colleges that offer summer courses and summer credits if the college kids come out and actually put work on the trail crew. So we're doing a lot of packing for them. We have a lot of volunteer organizations that put together people from all over the United States to come in and do trail work, give them experience, and we support those crews. Packing their food and their materials. We pack all sorts of things. There's nothing I haven't packed. I'm kind of brag about packing the odd things. I mean, I've packed Buck's toilets. I've packed 20-foot bridge beams. propane tanks, you know, the large 15, 16 gallon mm-hmm. propane tanks. There's a lot of weird stuff that they throw at me that they want me to pack. So I kind of take it as a challenge and try to figure it out of how to make it work and how to make it in. But, and then we do a lot of drop camps. People want their stuff dropped into the wilderness. Most people want to do it on their own, but they want the support of a pack mule. And what we're finding is that they can do it to get their, they can camp and they can do the hunting and they can do that kind of stuff, but they want the support of the pack mule to bring their camp in and pull their camp out. So that's mm-hmm. what we spend most of our summers doing.
Wow.
The, yeah, that's, I guess with, you have to sometimes dream up a whole new way of packing some odd object, get it safely up there. That's, packed everything. That's a good one. I like that. Well, what do you tell us a little bit about your the pack strings and the mules and horses you guys have, or and just how many you have, or what's it take to do all this?
So we have 14 mules personally on the string. We have 4 saddle horses that we rotate out. We average between 1,500 and 2,500 miles a year.
Per animal.
And I GPS wow. every animal and put a tracking, basically a tracking record with them. And 2 reasons for that. One reason is you say you travel that many miles in saddle and people call BS to you. The second reason is that you wear an animal out pretty quick when you put that many miles on. So it allows me to rotate animals through, and keep them up on their weight and keep them up on their physics. And if I see one starting to have a little bit of struggles, I'll give them a month off. So it allows me to say, well, this one's had 500 miles. This one's only had 3. This one's going on 1,000. So it's kind of a tracking record that way. I pick up animals in training, put them in just a pack string and give them a job to do. And so that 16 or 14 could go to 18 or 20, or it could just stay the 14, depending on how big of a load we have going on in the summer and how many trips we've got going on. And most of our mules have come to us as their problem children. Most of the people know that we're their last stop. They come to us and we'll put them in the pack string and we'll give them a job to do and make them understand that, you know, that's their job and make them like life again. And a lot of them come from troubled homes, been passed on, you know, and mostly it's not the mule's fault. It's the people who are handling the mules that don't understand the mule, and the mule's smarter than they are. So they come to us, we put them in the pack string, put them in the string, and then we get them to where they understand their job, and we'll either keep them or we'll place them. We've had a lot of good success placing troubled mules, give them a job, and they've turned into hellacious pack mules. So that's kind of the program.
Yeah, and we do have access to about 22 head of other animals that are close by that are real good friends that we can bring their stock in and rotate them into the string. There was one Forest Service job last year, volunteer job, that they had 3 different camps going 3 different directions, and so we had 36 head of mules on the line that day.
Wow. Wow. How long are you usually out with a pack string?
My season starts here about the 1st of May, and we'll go clear to the snows push us out in December. Average is probably 4 to 5 days. But we're gone every weekend or every, you know, 5 days at a time, 6 days at a time.
Wow. Wow.
And the way we got it set up, is we've got big trailers. So we pack 10 head into a trailer. And so we got 3 different trailers and outfits set up. So Casey will head up to a trailhead and he'll pack in, and I'll meet him 5 days later, another trailhead with another string and all the supplies that he needs. So he goes back in again. And then when he comes back out, maybe the 3rd time, I'll swap out and go back in with him, or go back out, swap back and forth. So I do the logistics now and meet him at the trailheads with all the equipment. So that way we keep fresh animals, fresh food, and that. So
when you arrive at a trailhead and unload your stock, how long does it take to be completely packed, all packed in, or you know, all packed, ready to head down the trail? How long does it take to put that many animals together and all packed in?
Usually, it depends on what we're packing and if we've packed, mm-hmm. if we've pre-packed or not. If we have to meet the trail crew, usually we're or dragging our feet on the trail crew. But an average day is when we get to trailhead, we try to go up the night before. We get up about 3 o'clock in the morning, start breakfast and coffee, and we start putting saddles on. Takes about 2 hours, 2.5 hours to get all the saddles on and adjusted. Depending on what the loads are, anywhere from 2.5 to 3 hours. If we have to build the loads, then it's 2.5, 3 hours. If all the loads are pre-built or the trail crews just come and dump everything off and they're already pre-weighed and everything, about an hour and 15, hour to 45 minutes to flap loads and have everything adjusted and be in the saddle. And we work in pairs. One guy on each side throwing the loads, adjusting the loads, and then throwing the knots back and forth, and we just work right down the line.
Yeah, my 14-year-old grandson.
Go ahead.
My 14-year-old grandson's worth about six people. He, you know, it's real orchestrated. There's just not one person doing one thing. When you get to a trail, it everybody has a job. The mules have a job. They all know. They come out of the trailer. They go to their spot. They know where to stand. When the saddles get on it, the grandson goes along and he starts tightening cinches and moving loads out. And Casey and I are pulling loads out of the trucks and setting up. Or like he says, if the trail crew shows up and they just dump everything on a tarp. Each thing requires a little more time or less time based on the loads. But it's orchestrated. There's not a single one of us that don't do another job. We all have the training to move from side to side to side, including our 14-year-old grandson. He's very, very effective at it. So it's really quick to get loads on in our perspective and down the trail.
Right. I was going to ask, what kind of weight does a mule carry?
Well, a mule will carry 20% of its live body weight. Most of our mules are 15 hands. So we're running, you know, 65 pounds a side, 70 pounds a side, and about 30 pounds on top, to give you a rough average. Anywhere from 150 to about 180 pounds total.
Okay.
And
okay.
I don't like overloading my animals because my animals have to last me all season. Does that make sense?
That makes absolute sense.
A mule is capable of carrying 200 pounds all day long, but you're going to burn them out really quick. So if you keep your loads light and fast and you put more miles on, they go longer for you and they perform better for you.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And we would rather run three extra mules in the string rather than overload the, you know, say 10 out front. We'd rather run three extra to get the loads down. And we can travel. We're putting 5 to 6 miles an hour, literally an hour. That's how fast we travel with these big mules.
Mm. Boy, that's going. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, Jim, you're aware of that. You've been there with us.
Yeah, I have. Well, you guys do your own haying too, don't you? You still do that? I remember recall that you did. You know, growing hay and harvesting.
And then right now, Jim, we're in the process of moving all of our hay equipment out to get started. We run 14 tractors. We run 5 mowers, and we've got 6 balers. And there's only 4 people that run all this equipment. So what we do is we have such a short window of opportunity here in our area to get the hay done. And the reason for it is it starts off kind of cool in June, and then by the end of June or 1st of July, we're already up to 100, 105 degrees. So we have a real short window of opportunity to do the haying. So what we do is we move the equipment out, all the equipment out to different fields. And then my wife and I, we get up early in the morning and start doing the mowing, and she'll do the raking in the afternoon. Casey comes in the afternoon, starts baling whatever fields we've got. So rather than moving equipment around, we got the equipment out there, and we just do a progressive leapfrog through all the fields. And we put up a significant amount of hay for our animals, plus we got cows. So we're talking right about 100, 150 tons of rounds, and we put in about 100 tons of squares just for our animals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you out there in Oregon, do you have 2 cuttings or 1?
1 cutting's all we get on the west side. We don't.
Okay.
It just dries out that quick.
Okay.
And plus, we want to be in the mountains. So, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I know that back here in the east, in my area, we try to get 2 cuttings of hay, and usually can do that. So I was just curious about that. You've got a little different climate out there. And then as you were getting ready to say, I guess you guys want to be back out in the mountains hauling during that period of time.
Yeah, as soon as we get an opportunity, once the hay's in the barn, that actually starts. It doesn't start the packing season because Casey will be pulling a lot before then. But what it does, as soon as the last bale's in the barn, we turn the cows out on all the pastures, and then we head to the mountains.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, Mr. McGarvey, I'm going to let you just keep on going because you had some great questions for these guys.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Backcountry Horsemen of Oregon and when you formed it, the first chapter, and what you're doing now or what's going on. A little bit of that background.
Yeah. BCHO, Backcountry Horsemen of Oregon, was formed in 2000. It was 96 is when the actual first chapter was formed. But around Oregon, we had different riding clubs and such that were out there. High Desert Trail Riders and a few other groups were going. So basically was brought in under one umbrella, all the trail groups that were out there. And they all had the same interest, and that was to get the trails open in the mountains and keep them open. So when it first started out, I started out in 2000 as a national director for Oregon, meaning that I myself represented Oregon back at the national Backcountry Horsemen of America meeting. So I've been involved since it actually got started, and it wasn't an actual group that had been in Backcountry Horsemen someplace else. It was just a lady from Washington called up and says, hey, we got all these groups down here. Why don't we put them together in one umbrella and join the national organization, BCHA? And that's how BCHO got started. And that was myself and a lady named Becky Hope that sat over a couple of Pepsis and said, let's make this happen. And that's where it's been since then. So,
well, that's... I know we always have issues or something going on with federal lands, some of the state lands, but is there any problems, I mean, not problems, but issues that arm wrestling or anything with outgoing in your Forest Service region? Anything particularly new that's coming up?
Well, it's not new. It's the same ongoing process we've got or problem. We got, of all of our wilderness, we've got 26 wildernesses here in Oregon. And of the wilderness that we have out there, 85% of our trails are closed right now, either due to large incidents such as fires or just the lack of any trail maintenance. The trail budget crews for Forest Service has been cut to just bare bones. I mean, actually, in our particular case here, they have enough for four people. The whole region only had enough for four people to be on the trail crews last summer in 2017. And so with that said, that means none of the trails are being opened up. And then after catastrophic events such as the large fires we've been having, which has been millions of acres out here the last couple of years, our trails are just flat closed. So BCHO and its volunteers have been taking their time and packing trail crews in, which are the trail crews, as we say, are like what Casey was saying. It's college students, and there's a lot of people throughout the United States that come out here and volunteer their time to the Forest Service to go walk a trail and cut it open. And so we've been providing the trail support, meaning we pack their tools and such that in and their food and their equipment all in. And but we've also got a large organization inside BCHO made up, we call strike teams. And those strike teams, we have specific groups that are set up for crosscut trained. And they take specific trails on. The Forest Service will call up and say, hey, we got a trail up here that needs to be opened up, and their trail crew needs assistance, so we'll move in and help them out. And an example, 7 years ago, we had a catastrophic wind event up in the Cascades, what we call the Three Sisters Wilderness, which now is burnt. But at that time, this wind event closed all the trails up. And this was back in the Obama era. And the stimulus money came out, and one of these trails from the west side of the Cascades we call Foley Ridge, they said they would not be able to open it up for maybe 8 to 10 years because of the amount of work that was involved. was going to be involved. And one of our young ladies in BCHO happened to be at the steering committee meeting when the money was being passed out on stimulus, and we got $1.3 million delegated towards this trail system. And so when we met with the Fed, we met with the Feds to go out and take a look at it, to open it up. Again, the criteria was that it probably take 8 to 10 years or longer to open it up. But you have to understand that the longevity of the Forest Service out here, they're all new people transferring in and out every 6 months to every year. So there is no local knowledge base left. We don't have any of the old timers that we're dealing with. So we were dealing with some new people that says, you know, it'll be 8 to 10 years. And I made the comment, which was probably a big mistake on my behalf, to say that, well, BCHO could step in and we could probably open that up in a year. So we put together a program, and they were able to get jumpers for training to go out and open some trails. They were able to take and put a 10-person crew up there with the stimulus money, and we put together 27 packers, and in 17 days, we had that whole trail system opened up completely.
Oh, my goodness.
So there's an example right there of how volunteers and the agencies can work together. Mm-hmm. But I can go for experience after experience after experience on that. So this year we were up in that same area, and Casey was pulling the trail crew in as the lightning storm hit, and we wound up having to pull the trail crews out, and they lost several thousand acres of that same area that we had opened the trails up to on 6 different large lightning fires. So it burnt it all.
Wow.
Well, one thing on that is, any prognostications here what the fire season is going to be like this year out there?
I'll tell you what, Jim, I have a real good answer to that. I'll let you know next December.
Okay, we'll have you on the show. You know, the lightning strikes where they go, okay.
I don't have a crystal ball.
You're right. Well, I didn't know if it was even dry out there. I mean, I know you've had a good bit of snow, but what that might mean. But it is early. Yeah, it is only April. Yeah, it's early April.
But Jim, that's not a true statement. We're only 35% of our normal for our snow.
Right.
Our reservoirs are looking good, but we don't have any snowpack at all. We've had rain down the lower country, but no snowpack.
Okay, well, that's not a good sign. Okay, well, let me move on to a little more of go ahead, Gary.
No, I was going to just say, why don't we take a real quick break and come back, and I think you probably were going to talk about packing, weren't you?
A little bit, yes.
A little bit. So this could be an interesting conversation. But let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk more with these gentlemen about the situation out in Oregon. And you're listening to Saddle Up America on the Equestrian Legacy Radio Network, heard around the world, streaming live, online, and on demand at equestrianlegacy.net.
I'm glad to be anywhere, but there's a place I like the best. On the chilly side of paradise, in the great and grand old west. And I'm a lucky boy, that's where I'm from. And that's where you can find me when it's all said and done. Yes, and I've seen the green of Tennessee, the colored lights of a New York night. Stood in a red sunset on the beach in Texas in the moonlight. But nothing sets my spirit free, and no other color can do. Like the winds of old Wyoming and call Rockies rising straight up through the cool blue air. Sip that cold white water running down to make you feel like a grizzly bear. And at sundown, I sit and watch him gleam. Never come so close to glory, not even in a dream. One night by the campfire light, we cooked up some rainbow trout. But she left me down around Pagosa Springs with a hook still in my mouth. I remember the mountain we used to ride. And a girl there with the sun in her hair and Colorado blue in her eyes. My native state and my dreams ain't coming true. When lost and lonesome is my fate, and it looks like I'm bound to lose. Is the homesick misfit's sorry face a thrashing in his own juice? Well, you can call that skinny cowpoke at the end of the bar. Colorado blue. Just call that skinny cowpoke at the end of the bar. Colorado blue.
Gary McMahon. Colorado Blue is the song, and we are talking with Jim McGarvey with Backcountry Horsemen of America today, as well as Phil and Casey Hufstetter. So I know, Jim, that you were going to get into a really, really interesting conversation in the second part of the show.
Well, we want to talk about, I think, the basis of the Backcountry Horsemen. To get to the Backcountry, he'll have to pack in, and our logos and that all show pack strings, and it's essentially what started the Backcountry Horsemen and keeping this tradition going. And you hear reports, I think, that the tradition may be growing. And, you know, it's one of the older traditions that turning around on its heels, it might be spreading. And as Casey and Phil said earlier about people coming out, colleges and the core folks coming out to help in the backcountry, there's growing need. I know it's happening in California and other Western states. I think if people, we have Gary's on the show here, we have around the world, and so a lot of folks not particularly understand what packing is. I think it's what settled parts of Europe and then helped settle America and explore America and open it up. And, because you can't take a wagon everywhere for sure, so with just on the single trails, can you maybe give us a little bit of a background? I know that talking to folks with the Backcountry Horsemen and that, there's Northern Wyoming has a style of packing that differs from Southern Wyoming. It's just a tradition. Each group swears by the way they do it and swears at the other way others do it, but. Maybe Casey or Phil, if you could talk about maybe the different packing styles or what's pluses and a minus, for instance, the sawbuck and the decker and those type of things, or differing knots. Where do you guys stand on that, and what kind do you guys use?
Okay, so let's cover it a little bit. There's two different styles of packing to get started with. One's a Manny packing, which is where you take everything and you put it in a tarp and you wrap it up like a big Christmas present. And you hang it on the side of a mule. And the style of pack saddle that you use for that is called a decker. And usually it's two wood bars with a steel hoop over the top. And you use what's called sling ropes. And you either tie a basket or a barrel and you manny the loads on the side of the animal. In Southern California, up in through northern, a lot of the Spanish influx, and they run what's called a sawbuck. And the sawbuck is what everybody's probably seen as an old wood tree with the crosses over the top, and you hang, they were originally designed to hang baskets on the donkeys and the burros, but you hang pannier bags. Both have their places, both have their differences, both have their unique techniques of packing and their unique art to them. There's not a right or wrong way, it's just the way you've come from or where you've come from, and the reason you come from is how you learned. I actually run what's called a Phillips Form Fitter, put out by Outfitters Pack Station. It's a innovative tree that moves with the animal. It flexes with the animal. It has a set of Decker bars over the top, steel, with a set of nubs welded on the side so you can hang bags. I have to be versatile in my packing. I can't just say one style is going to fit. I have to be versatile and be able to pack anything. I have to be able to go from packing pannier bags on one side to packing a beam or a culvert on the other side with sling ropes, or putting a set of fifth wheel hitches on the top and packing a full beam. So I have to be versatile in all forms of packing. So for me to say, this is the only way to do it, I've kind of gotten away from the old school, this is the only way to do it. I pretty much look at every aspect and every load is a different way and a different challenge. And what is it going to take? And it might take all three, it might be a sling load with a bag on it with a sling load wrapped around it, and throw things over the top, throw a hitch over the top to hold it all in place. It each one depends on the load that I'm packing. I prefer to do pannier bags. Easy for it is because you can weigh everything out, you hang them, and you go. That's where my speed comes from, is everything's pre-weighed, and you get really good at weights. One of the key weights a guy needs to know about is what's the best thing to balance out your load. That's why they say the good Lord made rocks. Well, that's why the good Lord made soda or beer, you got to know what a half case of Coors Light weighs 24 pounds. Now, the opposite of that's what's a case of Coors weigh? 25. It must be in the can, the only thing I can figure out. But if you figure out it, whether it's a case of beer or a case of pop, that's 12 ounces at a time you can balance your load. And you get to looking at things and start thinking, well, that's 6 pounds, that's 5 pounds, that's 2 pounds, that's 4 pounds. You get to knowing the weights of things really quick. So with pannier packing, which is the basis of what we do, which is a set of pannier bags, whether they're canvas bags or iron cloth bags, which is what I've been using mostly because canvas is not the quality it used to be anymore. So we've gone to modern day materials to hold up. You just throw your loads, you hang them, you level them, you throw your top pack on top. I run the Walker hitch, which was developed by a gentleman named Gordon Jesse Walker. He was a packer for the Siskiyous out of Klamath Falls, down towards Northern California. It's an innovative hitch because he was a Forest Service packer. He built it. It pulls the load out and away. It's two half hitches that work against each other. So as you go down the trail, it actually tightens up, which is beautiful. And it's the only hitch that you can reach under and flip the knot underneath off the lash cinch, and you can roll the whole load that's still tied together off the animal if you get in trouble.
Wow.
It's interesting that you're open to, and it makes so much sense, open to all styles or need depending on what you have to carry. And the weight of a case of Coors, it's okay. That's good stuff.
You caught Jim's attention with that.
Yeah, right.
I know I did. I figured I'd get everybody's attention with that.
Yeah. Well, Casey, I know that the last several times been with you or met, you were doing packing clinics, and I think that's a good part of your work too. Can you tell us a little bit about that and where you do it and who's your audience is and all about that?
So Cody and I get hired to travel all up and down the Northwest, and the reason I started doing this a lot is what we found is somebody goes and they buy all the gear offline. They get the old horse out from the backfield that's been mowing grass for 2 years, and they're going to go packing. And they put all the stuff on, and number one, it doesn't fit. Number two, they don't have a clue about safety of what they're doing. And 2 to 3 miles down the trail, they have an absolute explosion. And the either people are hurt or the horses are hurt or they have such a bad experience that it leaves a bad taste in their mouth that they quit it altogether. So I've been going around in starting here in April, and I go from April to about mid-June, putting on packing clinics and demonstrations. And we start from the basics of, you know, high line and hobbling and how the saddle fits your animal and how to set up the saddle to full-blown packing schools of people coming out and learning, using their animals, setting all the gear up, and then going in and actually doing it with somebody there to not necessarily tell them how to do it, but tell them that, you know, if you do this and you do this, it'll make things a little bit easier, making sure that they're safe in doing it. We travel all over, talk to all sorts of different groups, the Northwest Youth Corps, Boy Scouts. We go to large events, equestrian groups. We talk to them, just basic trail riding as well. You know, simple thing is carrying a first aid kit, a coat and a saddle saw, because you don't know how much trouble you can get into if you just go for a day ride. Cover all the bases, cover all the different styles, talk about equipment and fitting your gear, talking about how the animals, you know, how the proper fitting gear will affect your animals' saddle fit. So we travel around. We have a big event that happens in May in Klamath Falls at the Pack Clinic. I travel to different backcountry horseman rendezvous all the way from Southern California clear up into Washington, teaching the different ways to pack and the different arts of packing. So that's mostly my spring, is traveling most weekends teaching pack clinics.
Well, that's, I could see your description of the somebody buying the equipment, you know, online and then throwing it on and having some real problems. Have you, or what kind of, are you hear of accidents out on the trails? What do you think, after all years of hearing these and maybe having a couple, what's the main risk to packing that the people need to look out for when they're going down the trail with a string,
well,
or even one?
So the main, I mean, let's, you know, there's all sorts of risks that are out there, but the main risk is the equipment fitting the animal. If the pack saddle is pinching the animal is going to be upset. So it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's a stick that pokes it, or you get into yellow jackets, or they see a hiker, or they hear a strange noise. If the animal's uncomfortable, they're going to look for a reason to explode. So the number one thing is the equipment fitting the animal. I'm really big on saddle fit, and I'm really, really big on proper equipment to fit the animal. There is very, very little literature out there on how to properly set up a pack saddle, how to properly adjust a pack saddle, or even that matter, riding saddle. So when people get started, usually they are on the, you know, they're on a budget, so they buy what they can afford, which there's nothing wrong with that. But you want to make sure you just don't go pull something out that you bought at a garage sale that's meant for a donkey and put it on a draft horse.
Right.
And you laugh, but this is what happens. People get into something reasonable, yeah, and they think it's going to work, and they read a whole bunch of literature on it, and, well, they look at a bunch of pictures, and they put it down on there, and then they don't understand why the draft horse goes and explodes, and all their gear is scattered all over the place. I would say the main safety reason is improper equipment fit. The second safety thing would be bees and animals, or bees and hikers. I'm not saying that's hikers, but that's saying the different colors and the backpacks, the form of a human is bigger than what a normal human is. And then inexperience of animals that are on the trail. You can't take the horse that's been standing out in the pasture for 2 years, eating the grass down and putting them in the high steep country and expect them to perform without conditioning them. A lot of what happens is like any human being, they sit all winter at the computer desk, and then they're going to go hike Mount Everest. You know how far they're going to get. The horses are the same way. If there's no conditioning that comes along with them, the horses are going to get sore, their muscles are going to get tight, and they're either, number one, going to just quit, or they're not going to go any further because their muscles tighten up.
Yes. Okay. Well, you know, you mentioned, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Then the other issue that we're having, which is really detrimental to a large string, is our elevation's change, we can start at the trailhead and we can climb 4,000 or 5,000 feet and drop over the saddle, drop down. And some of our trails are wide enough that we're talking about 12 inches, 14 inches, and you got pack stock on it. And you got a string of 14, you're dropping down into Three Sisters Wilderness, down what we call Mesa Creek, which is a steep, narrow trail. And here comes a mountain biker around the corner, and it's illegal for them to be in the wilderness. And this mountain biker comes around, his head's down, doing a high rate of speed, and he comes up behind the string. The rider's out front, and so he's leading the string, and here comes this mountain bike up behind. And what's an animal? Their response is flight or fight. And this particular case, something comes up behind them, you know, they take off, and so a whole string goes down over the side. And we had a heck of a wreck when this happened, and the person kept on going. Even though it was illegal for them to be there, that's still what happened. So now we've had to change our safety practices on how we deal. We have now an outrider out front. We have a drag rider who's dragging in the back that stays at least 100 to 200 feet behind the string, so that if anything happens, they can turn sideways. And generally, we mount them on an old plug, one of our old mules that's not about to have any issues. And so they can turn sideways and block. We run between 3 to 5 dogs with us at all times. The dogs are at ground level, so they get in the bees first instead of the mules. So when they get in, we can pretty much tell where the yellow jackets' nests are. We can move out. And then the outrider out front, he blocks anybody coming from the front. And we do everything physically to get off the trail. If there's any hikers or anybody coming, we try to get the string off. But there are certain places physically impossible. Oh, and, Jim, you saw some of that country coming off of Mount Jefferson where you close your eyes, let the animal do its job. Well, you can't afford to have an accident up there, so you go prepared and try to do as much training with your stock and have safety practices such as the dogs and such as outriders.
Well, you know, you mentioned the bees, and that's a big problem down here. I got stung so much I'm allergic to them now and take my epinephrine pen. But the yellow jackets, as in Georgia Tech, named after them, but the state vet in Georgia said that the number one cause for horse accidents in Georgia is the yellow jackets. That's throwing people off and horses bucking. So, yeah, with a pack string, I can see that could be really chaos if you don't get a handle on it. And those mountain bikers, yellow jackets and mountain bikers. Casey, had an interesting thing happen to you during one of your clinics. You had somebody from Europe was in attendance, and that brought you on to sort of a journey.
I did a clinic in Angels Camp. Cody and I did a clinic in Angels Camp, California. And there was an individual there that was from overseas. And they came to me and asked if I'd be interested in going overseas and packing and teaching packing. And I kind of, you know, I thought it was more lip service than anything. I wasn't real sure. And then she wound up being really good friends with Simone Mall of Outfitters Pack Station, who is originally from Europe. And originally from Germany, and got to talking, and they actually do a pack trip through all the European countries every 2 years over there. So they invited Wade and Simone and myself over this past September. We took off September 5th, and we did not get back until the 1st of October. We were invited to the international packing, they call it a meeting, which is interesting. They call it the International Pack Animal Meeting. And people from all over the European states get together, or European countries get together, and they go on a pack trip.
Wow.
And we were invited to go, and we met a gentleman that put it together that was named Marcus Trishburn, and he was out of Innsbruck, and he is the one that put the whole thing together. We literally showed up at Marcus's house, and we had 50 people and 27 to 30 pack animals that were there at Marcus's house.
Wow.
We started out in downtown Innsbruck. And when I mean downtown Innsbruck, we started out in his back 5 acres or 3 acres that he had. And we packed everything up that morning, and we walked out, walked down the street, crossed the street light, crossed the parking lot of the grocery store, walked up the cobblestone road through the tunnel, and went through the tunnel, out meandered out through the farms and the neighborhoods until we hit the pack trail that led up into the Alps. We overstayed the first night. We went seven, or the first day we went 7 miles, or seven metric miles, as I kept calling it, because I couldn't do the conversion in kilometers.
Metric mile.
So we went 7 metric miles. Stayed at a little, I guess the best way to call it would be like a hotel or a motel, but it was set up for animals, and it was a dairy, and they fed us. And then the next day we got up, and Marcus said the first day we needed to be on the trail with all these people at, we wanted to be on the trail at 9 o'clock. Well, we didn't leave his house until like 11:30. So the next morning he said that we had to cover 18 metric miles, so we needed to be on the trail by 9:30 at the latest. And so I says, well, if you get everybody together and get their animals loaded up, and have them step back, we'll step out of their way, or step out of my way, and I'll give them a hand. So Wade and I started into them 30 animals, and we were 9:45, we had everything packed, ready to go. And I turned to Marcus and says, well, I'm sorry, I'm 15 minutes late. And he was just ecstatic that we were 15 minutes late, not 2 hours late. So we walked up, clear up. We gained elevation like crazy. The interesting thing over there is they don't ride an animal and lead their pack animal. They walk and lead a pack animal.
Wow.
Which was... When we showed up and I had my buckaroo saddle ready to ride and figure out where my lead horse was, and they were looking at me weird, like, why'd you bring that, you know? So we walked that whole distance leading an animal. And
wow.
We gained, you know, 2,000 foot of elevation in, you know, a mile and a half. So it was pretty steep country, straight up, straight down, and it was a good workout for my legs and my lungs, I can tell you that. And the whole time I was wishing, where's my lead horse? Where's my lead horse? The equipment that they were using was, a lot of the stuff was World War I, World War II stuff, and a lot of stuff that they'd bought off the internet, but they didn't understand the concept or the principle, how it worked or how it fit. Now keep in mind that most of the European countries spent most of their time rebuilding themselves after the two world wars. So the knowledge and the experience were lost with people either in the conflict, or they spent so much time trying to rebuild their economy and getting back into it that it wasn't something that was thought about. So now everything's going good, and the younger generations are getting into it because it's something that their grandparents did, or they remember their great-grandparents doing it, and they remember growing up on the farm, and they want to recreate that. So they learned a lot. I taught a lot. We got held up in a small sheep herders kind of village, summer camp, that they call it, up in the Alps. And what happened was is it snowed so much that they closed the trail down. They didn't want anybody up on the trail because of safety hazards. So we got the first snow, and we got 6-8 inches of snow, and it got deeper the higher you went, and the trail got too dangerous. So we hung up at this sheep herder's cabin, summer cabin, for 3 or 4 days. And what we did is we pretty much just had a 3 or 4 day pack clinic. We talked about saddle fit. We talked about the different animals. And we're talking, they packed everything from miniature donkeys to Icelandic ponies, or Norwegian fjords, to halflingers, to 17-hand performance mules. Halflingers, performance mules, some fancy mules that some people had imported in from actually Tennessee. They had Tennessee walking mules there. So there was a gamut of animals from, you know, 13 hands clear up to 17 hands, and a gamut of an array of and variation of pack saddles, from sawbucks to old World War I handmade Swiss pack saddles to World War II 1-inch square tubing pack saddles that weighed 125 pounds. I mean, it just an array of stuff that they had that they were packing.
So were you able to help them out on that to say, okay, let's get some equipment in?
Yeah, we took some equipment over that Outfitters Pack Station makes, the Form Fitter Pack Saddle. We took three or four of them over there, and we sold three or four. We sold some bags. We explained to them how it fits and how to make it fit, but we also explained to them the gear that they had. We went through, and like I say, we had that 3 or 4 days of just being snowed in, and so we had 3 or 4 days of fitting all the gear, helping them fit the gear that they had, making them fit, showing them the adjustments, showing them how they fit. So we went through that 30-some animals and fit all the gear properly, got everything set up, and then we worked with them on different knots and different hitches and how they could pack different things, and showed them the whole array and gamut of things that they could do with the different materials that they had there and with the different gear that they had there. And a lot of it was, this is what we pack, and this is what we do. We take on a day trip, or this is what we take on a weekend trip. And so we showed them how to pack all the stuff that they take all the time. Now, keep in mind that their pack trips, or their travels, or their walkabouts, whatever you want to call it, are anywhere, they're based on from village to village. They don't have to pack stuff, 100 pounds, 200 pounds like we do, because there's another village only 5 miles.
Right.
And so they can just pack enough stuff for a day and then go to the next village and buy new stuff and go for the next day.
Oh, okay.
It was pretty interesting, and a lot of the stuff was light and fast, and we only need this for a couple of days, where we think we're going for 5 days or we're going for 10 days and we need to take everything to survive. They're only looking at 3 days travel at a time.
Right. So do you have another trip back to Europe planned or in the works?
I do. We're working on going back to probably Switzerland in 2019.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So that's not too far off. Not too far off.
Yeah. The interesting part about that is you'll be going over there to teach the military how to pack on the new stuff. So.
Oh, that's great.
Help out.
Oh.
that's really great.
I want to throw in one real quick war story before we end, and that's the fact that we pulled up at a trailhead up out of Mount Washington Wilderness here in Oregon, and this couple showed up, and they had several kids, and they only had one pack animal. So out of the back of the truck, they brought a rug, a large rug. They laid the rug flat on the ground, and they loaded all their stuff, sleep bags, food, everything in that rug. Then they rolled that rug up and took a bungee cord, tied it on each end of the rug, and then they loaded that rug on the top of a riding saddle of an animal, and they took off down the trail. That was their load.
Oh, wow.
We loaded our stock up. We were behind them, wanted to give them get them up the trail past the switchback so we wouldn't catch them on the switchback. And at the first switchback, we found spaghetti. Second switchback, we found the tent. by the time we got 5 miles in, we had 2 pack loads of their stuff that we gathered up. It was like a shopping spree for us, but we got up there, and here was the kid still leading the horse and the family out front hiking, and they didn't have a clue that all their gear was strung out for 5 miles. So with that said, there is a need for clinics. There is a need for Casey going around and putting on some of these things and helping people out, because it's a lost art in a lot of places.
Yeah. Well, you guys have been entertaining and a lot of fun to have on the show today. Do you have a website where people can visit and reach out to you? Facebook page, maybe?
I do. I have a Facebook page at CH Packstring is my Facebook page. And then I have a website that's www.casey@chpackstring.com. And it kind of gives you all the pictures, and there's a whole deal on there, meet the mules, and kind of gives you a roundabout of puts my ugly mug up there. I took it off the wanted poster, so it matches everything. but it kind of gives you shows you different pack strings and different pictures and the different country that we cover, and kind of gives you a description of what we do what the pack string does and the trail, you know, kind of the adventures that happen every summer. So,
right. Well, be sure and check out
a lot of pictures of the grandson on there. So,
well, be sure and check out their website and also their Facebook page. And again, you guys have been very informative and a lot of fun to talk with today. So, Jim McGarvey, do you have anything that's going on with Backcountry Horsemen of America right now that we need to mention?
Well, I think the national board meeting is coming up in later in April at Spokane, Washington. So I think folks in that area will certainly know about it and be attending. It's a nice area close to the mountains. And a lot of good folks up there. So I think that's the next thing on the event there. So for the Backcountry Horsemen.
All right. And your website, again, for folks that need to check out Backcountry Horsemen and get involved.
BCHA.org, BCHA.org.
Couldn't get any easier, BCHA.org. So it has been a lot of fun to have you guys on the show today. And for our audience out there, be sure and tune in next Thursday for the Campfire Cafe beginning at noon Central Standard Time, followed by Saddle Up America at 1. And we want to remind you, as always, if you climb in the saddle, to get ready for the ride on Equestrian Legacy Radio, heard around the world, streaming live, online, and on demand. All of our shows are archived. So, Jim, I think right now they can go back and listen to 500 different shows if they'd like to. And
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So just jump right in and visit our website. Visit our Facebook page, too, Equestrian Legacy Radio, and like us on there. And we're going to close out the show today with a great song from Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. It's called Happy Trails, and that's what we wish you today. And be sure to tune in next week for another issue of Equestrian Legacy Radio. Thanks for listening.
Happy Trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Happy trails to you till we meet again. Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing a song and bring sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet again. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?
Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather.
Happy trails to you.